This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Okay, so how's this new year been treating you so far? Here at T-Book Central, when we get into the first few cold days of January, our thoughts almost always drift off to summer camp. But instead of sack races and soggy sheets, this camp involves lofty goals and big ideas.
A Mars helicopter. Now that is classic NASA thinking.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, our astrobiology series goes to camp, the 6th annual ExxonMobil Bernard Harris Summer Science Camp. We'll also spend an academic minute keeping our eyes peeled for a stray supernova or two. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. While most of us were goofing off this past summer, groups of middle school students from around the country took on the role of NASA scientists. Each year, more than 50 universities compete to host the ExxonMobil Bernard Harris Summer Science Camp. Now, in its 6th year, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute invited middle schoolers from around New York's Capital District to design a mission to Mars to extract materials from areas of the planet thought to harbor signs of life. Teams of students developed proposals for the mission, and this year's winning group came up with an idea that quite simply blew the judges away. The Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter David Gustina spoke to the winning team and their parents, as well as RPI physics professor Wayne Roberage, about last summer's program.
I'm here today representing the New York Center for Astrobiology. We partner with Dean Cynthia Smith in the School of Engineering. Every year, Cynthia writes a proposal to the ExxonMobil Bernard Harris folks. She wins the proposal, and we partner with her to provide content for the Harris Summer Science Camp.
And of course, we're in our 6th consecutive year with the Summer Science Camp and another bunch of bright-eyed young people sitting around the table with us. But Professor, first your take on the program and the kids this year.
Every year, it's a wonderful experience. The thing that strikes me year after year is how close these young people are to being scientists. Most, if not all of these students, in just maybe 2 years when they get to high school, will be doing real scientific research. And from what I've seen, they're just absolutely ready.
Because they're young, because they haven't been jaded by time, let's say, and by other maybe preconceptions about science, in which scientists who have learned a lot of theories and use those as benchmarks to move on to the next area of research, is it, well, I don't know how to put this, even more likely that they might see things with open, fresh eyes?
Oh, absolutely. There are many examples of people who conceived ideas at a young age and clung to them. The one that comes to mind is John Mather, who won the Nobel Prize in Physics a few years ago for a mission which revolutionized cosmology. And he had that idea at a relatively young age, not middle school, but young, and clung to it. So absolutely. Ideas have nothing, or originality of ideas, in my humble opinion, has nothing to do with age.
And this program certainly proves it. Give us a sense of what the students did this year and why they were part of the winning team.
So these folks were the team that blew away the panel of judges. They had a science competition. They were given a document which is very similar to what I would receive from NASA headquarters saying, we would like you to submit a proposal for a mission to Mars, a follow-on to the Mars Science Laboratory, which has the Curiosity rover. Except that their challenge was actually much more difficult than the Curiosity mission because they were asked to land in a place that was quite dangerous. And they came up with just a phenomenally original approach to that.
Including, from what I understand, a machine, I don't even know what you call it, helicopter-like, that could move to a number of spots that were chosen.
A Mars helicopter. Now that is classic NASA thinking. A few years ago, I heard about some folks out in California at a NASA center thinking, wouldn't it be cool to have a Mars airplane? Now, of course, the atmosphere of Mars is 100 to 1,000 times thinner than the atmosphere of Earth. So this is a tremendous technological challenge. But our group here said, oh, no, we'll go further than that. We'll make a helicopter.
Do scientists do enough to make a lot of these subjects understandable to the general public? And is this program a way to help that?
It absolutely is. The grant which supports the New York Center for Astrobiology has a significant part of our effort directed toward education and public outreach. And at this point, if I may, I'd like to point out that I am here as the successor to Professor John Delano, who really has done all this until he stepped down recently. I'm just the caretaker, if you will. So to return to your original question, education and public outreach are absolutely crucial, because if we did not do that, the audience for our work would just be the people who know more or less what we know, and not necessarily the people who will do the great things in 2 years or 5 years or whatever it's going to be for the people in this room.
Well, and when you have scientists like yourself and Lori Leshin, who has been instrumental in working with the Curiosity, you can easily see how, especially in Lori's case, she makes it exciting and fun for young people.
She does. She's gifted that way, as John Delano is. And we, the rest of us, do try to make an effort to do what you said, to make it understandable, because science is not hard to understand. It's hard to do. It's a job like any other job that's difficult to do well, but to understand it is not the difficult part, I don't think.
Professor Roberge, I can't tell you how much we appreciate you sharing your thoughts about the program. What do you say we talk to these young people about their project?
Absolutely. I want to hear what they have to say.
Hi, I'm Janiyah Hart. I was in sixth grade when I was in the program going to seventh, and I was a physicist in the group.
Hello, I'm Joseph Byrd. I was in seventh grade of the program, and now I'm going into eighth. I was the biologist and geologist.
Hi, I'm Hannah Canfield, and I was in seventh and going into eighth. I was the mathematician of the project.
I'm Tyler Passy. I was the educational specialist. I was in sixth grade in the program, and I'm going into seventh grade.
What a group of young people we have here before us. And of course, this is the Bernard Harris ExxonMobil Summer Science Camp. They're in their sixth consecutive year. We're speaking with young people who've come from schools around the capital region of New York, and they attended a summer camp for a couple of weeks at RPI. Now, Janiyah and Joseph and Hannah and Tyler are here before me. And probably the most important thing to ask you first is, what was it like to be at college for 2 weeks? Go ahead, Hannah.
It was really exciting because I never really spent that long away from home, not 2 weeks. And it was really exciting because I got to spend time in a dorm and with a bunch of people that I really didn't know until I got used to them. And then taking classes and being out all day, it was really exciting.
What about you, Tyler?
I really like the dorms and the dorm rooms because every day the boys would like run up and down the hallway playing some game, and it was fun. Really fun.
What about the educational experience?
It was unique being in classrooms that big.
Now, what about you, Janiyah?
I like the classrooms a lot because they told us a lot of things and we were hands-on with most projects. And they were, if someone didn't get anything, they'll go more deeper into the subject and help everybody understand. And I really like the dorms.
Yeah, you guys seem to really like those dorms. I want to know what games they're playing in the hallway. I do remember my college years. Okay, Joseph.
It was a very interesting experience. Really fun. All the different classes and hands-on approaches. Getting lectures from the professors, it was all really interesting.
Now, you also met Bernard Harris, the first African-American to go into space, and certainly someone who has created a program, this summer science camp, and replicated it around the country at major universities, including the CUNY system down in New York City. What was it like to meet someone like Bernard Harris? Anybody?
It was really interesting.
How come?
Because he was the first African-American to be in space.
And just because we're on the radio, I will say you are African-American. So did it give you a feeling that, hey, I could be walking in space someday too?
Yes.
That's wonderful. How about you, Janiyah?
Yeah, same thing with me. And I was like, oh my gosh, when I saw him, I was awestruck.
What do you think, Joseph?
Meeting him was really inspirational, listening to all his stories of how his trips went and all he's done.
Yeah. Well, now we get to the fact that you're put into these teams. And I'm sure in the beginning, Hannah, you're like, I wonder how this is all going to work out. But then you're in a room and you're working together. How do these various roles you told us about, the educational person, the physicist, the various ones that you've mentioned, how did they get decided? Go ahead, Hannah.
Well, we all had to be in a group, and they gave us these roles. And so each of us told each other what they were good at. And so we separated it from that on what we can do as roles.
And again, let's give our roles. Janiyah, you were?
Physicist.
Joseph?
Biologist and geologist.
Well, how did you get two?
Well, one of us was supposed to have two, and I got two.
Hannah.
Mathematician.
Yes. And Tyler?
Educational specialist.
What did the educational specialist do, Tyler?
So they basically directed questions to the right person. Like if it was a math question, I directed Hannah. Rocks and minerals question, I directed to Joseph.
So you're sort of the catch-all. You get all the stuff coming into you, and you kick it out to the various players in the game. No wonder you like those games in the hallway. Well, listen, what's important here is your project. So what I'd love for you to do is for each of you to talk a little bit about what you did, talk about the mission, maybe if you want to pick someone to set up what the mission was, and then go into each of your roles, what you discovered, and I especially would love it if you could tell us how you discovered this idea about the helicopter. Go ahead, Joseph.
Well, as I think it was previously stated, we had to make a mission for Mars. And so we were given resources, we were given an amount of expenses to use. And from there, we had to plan the most practical, both scientifically and safely, to get our rover to Mars and complete its scientific goals.
And forgive me for this interruption, what was your budget?
$750 million.
Yeah. Curiosity's budget was more.
Yeah. And in fact, even though I sounded like I was thinking that was a high number, mathematician Hannah, we know that in NASA's terms, that's not that expensive a mission, is it?
No.
And in fact, you were able to, Joseph, work on that practical part. Make sure that it was as cost-effective as possible, yes?
Yes, we had to choose the landing zone that was safest and yet would most benefit our scientific goals.
Still to come, David Gustina's look back at the ExxonMobil Bernard Harris Summer Science Camp continues with a look at finding the right neighborhood on Mars. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1216. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guests today are the students, teachers, and parents involved in the ExxonMobil Bernard Harris Summer Science Camp, held last summer at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. They're speaking with The Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter, David Gustina.
Give the listeners a sense of these areas. I have a picture, for example, that I pulled out before that has these circles around these areas and a spot on Mars. What are their names? And what did you end up deciding in terms of which was most important, where you could go?
Well, that map you had, the whole area was Nili Fossae, which translates to the Nile. It's a very rocky region in Mars, which for the longest time it's been an interesting place that we could study, but we're unable to because of our landing zone radius.
And what does that mean?
Well, your landing ellipse. That's the area where when your rover lands, it could land anywhere in there. And it's too rocky for Curiosity to land there. But over time, it's getting more pinpoint, so we could be able to land in places like that.
Fantastic. And so let's continue this. Does anybody want to pick up the story? How do you end up, Hannah? Now you have these regions. How do you decide what you're going to do? And if you can't land, what do you do?
Well, we were given 3 minerals. And they were minerals that can prove that there was life on Mars, which was mainly what the project was about.
What were the minerals?
Clay, olivine, and carbonate. And having too much olivine, it's not that good. So you want as little as possible because it could harm your rover. It could get inside its system. So.
And what is the consistency of this substance, this mineral? Is it dusty or is it sandy?
It's like sandy and dusty. It's kind of like the volcano stuff.
And that, of course, damages planes if they come into a contact with an ash cloud. And of course, we have problems in desert climates with the sandstorms and the propellers on planes and the systems in planes. So this is certainly understandable from that perspective, Hannah. So you got to be careful about that.
So we didn't want to land in a crater because we might fall down, it might break, and we might not be able to get up the crater to get where we needed to go. So that rules out the crater, which was mostly part of Nilae Fossae. So we didn't want to land in the middle of nowhere because then it would take too long to get where we needed to be. So we landed in an area that has clay and carbonate, but a little more clay. That's where we landed. And then we took a route around the crater, which looked like the Nile. That's why it's like called Nilae Fossae. And we took that down into a crater, but it wasn't too big of a slant, so it was hard to get down. So we took it down and then down into the crater.
Now, you're the mathematician, so are you working this out mathematically? Has NASA given you numbers to figure out?
Mm-hmm.
Give us a sense of what are you doing?
Well, I'm trying to figure out how many stops we need to have and how long it would take, because we don't know how long our rover can last before it breaks down. So I'm trying to figure out how much stops we need to take and how long it will get, because if it's too long of a route, we might not be able to fill our goal.
Were there any places you had decided to land before you landed on your final spot? Did you have other spots? Give us a sense of that, Janai.
Well, we had many other places we wanted to land, but then we were sort of ruling them out because they're too rocky or too far away. And we wanted to end up in an ancient riverbed. We didn't want to take too long, and we didn't want to go in craters like Hannah just said.
Sure. But Tyler, for you, what did you think of the process in terms of negotiating these things?
It took a long time because there were like 5 different spots that we all wanted to choose. So it took us a long time to rule them out.
So, Joseph, pick it up from there. So how do you get to this helicopter we've been hearing about?
Well, originally, after we had started planning the mission, the idea came from 2 members, one of them is not with us today, came from Tyler and Rufus, where they thought, hey, what if we have this probe, like a helicopter probe, which leaves the rover, heads around to spots, checking them out, seeing which the rover would want to analyze and which it could analyze. And at first, we didn't really consider it because of the lack of air on Mars. But they looked more into it and found that NASA itself was already planning a probe such as this. And so we decided to add it to our rover.
Now, this sounds Transformer-like. I mean, is this helicopter part of the rover and then it detaches from it?
Yes. If you see the size of Curiosity, we can't just have 6-foot-long, tall as you rover just pop a helicopter out of its back and fly around on Mars.
So the most effective way to do it, it seems to me you're saying, is we land in this sweet spot and this thing detaches itself and goes to the other places.
Yeah, it's a lot more effective and can be used even with the lack of air because it's going to be very small and also made of ultralight parts.
And to accomplish what you're going to accomplish, what else is on this helicopter? Because obviously you have to go and observe, right? And somehow you got to get a sample or something. I mean, continue this.
Well, it's just small analyzation tools to pick up samples. See, the main analyzation happens in the actual rover. So the helicopter picks up the samples and comes back to the rover. Inside the rover are all sorts of tools. It's basically a mobile laboratory.
So how did you figure that out? Hannah?
Well, we were looking towards not just on the NASA website, but we were looking more towards helicopters and how they work and if we could add things to them to make them do what we wanted it to do.
And as you sit here in this studio and you look at your project, and you, of course, won the competition, you were the winners. You went a little bit further, but does it inspire you to continue in science in the future?
Definitely.
Definitely.
I'm kind of debating. I want to do something disease, nanoscience, or something such as that.
That's wonderful. What about you, Janaya?
Either want to find out how we could actually provide life on other planets or how we could cure cancer.
I'm Jacqueline Hart, and my daughter is Janaya Hart. And I was very excited about the camp because it's the first year I ever heard about it. And I'm very pleased with all the things she learned and the experience she had. And it made her very excited about going to college. So excited about that.
I'm Danielle Kim. My son is Joseph Byrne, and I am very pleased with this program and this wonderful opportunity he had.
I'm Tina Healy. My daughter is Hannah Campfield. It was our first year experience this camp, and I thought it was amazing.
You know, no small part of this is your parenting. You obviously have spent a great deal of time raising these young people, trying to make sure they have the best opportunities that they can have to be successful. And this is one example of how to get there. You know, they had to go away. And you couldn't really talk to them. Now, I know Cynthia had the emergency cell phone, and if there was a meltdown, a call could be made. But this is an early tease for what it might be like in the future. What was that like, Moms?
Well, I really wasn't worried because Joseph is very adaptable, thank God, especially since I was a single parent for years and his father, we shared custody. So that's a great thing to be when you're young, because then you can learn to overcome things.
Did you hear him talking? Did he not sound like a scientist from NASA?
He sounds a lot better than I would, that's for sure.
And that's the goal, isn't it, Danielle?
Yes, definitely. I want him to go above and beyond what I could ever imagine for myself.
What else can we ask? Go ahead, Jack.
I wasn't too worried about Janiyah. Just like Danielle, I'm a single mother, and I raise my daughters to be very independent and, you know, think for themselves and to be a leader, not a follower. And if you are going to be a follower, follow the right people. Hmm. So I wasn't too worried about her. She did very well. I'm proud of her.
And how about you?
I really missed her. Me and Hannah are very close.
It's tough then,
yes,
right?
It was tough.
Were there any phone calls?
Hannah was in the nurse's office one time and I got a phone call. So that was expected. It was a nice phone call.
You're glad, actually.
Yes, I was absolutely.
I hope you're not really sick, but thank you for calling.
Absolutely.
But I'm sure beyond that, though, you're very glad that she's
here. Oh, I'm very happy. She's accomplished so much in her life.
The 6th annual ExxonMobil Bernard Harris Summer Science Camp was held last summer at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. Thanks to all of the participants who spoke with the Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter, David Gustina, as part of our astrobiology series on the origins of life. Our coverage is made possible by the NASA Astrobiology Institute through support from the New York Center for Astrobiology, located at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York, in partnership with the University of Albany, the University of Arizona, and Syracuse University. To learn more about all of the topics in our astrobiology series, go to origins.rpi.edu. Well, as long as we've gone to Mars, we might as well just keep on going till we reach the stars. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. A supernova is a rare event, so rare that modern astronomers have never caught one in the act. But as Christopher Kochanek, professor of astronomy at Ohio State University, reveals, the odds will be in astronomers' favor in coming decades.
Fortunately for us, our sun is a boring, long-lived, middleweight star. Bigger stars live faster and die younger. Some even explode, and for a month or so, these supernova explosions can outshine the entire galaxy of stars in which they live. We can see the remnants of supernovae for thousands of years as enormous clouds of hot expanding gas. Their numbers say that there should be a supernova in our galaxy every 50 to 100 years, but the last time anyone looked up in the sky to see one was 1604. We easily see the belt of stars that is our Milky Way galaxy, so how can we be missing explosions that are brighter than all those stars combined? The answer lies in what astronomers call dust. Dust is like the soot particles you see belching out of a diesel truck. In certain phases of their lives, stars do the same, blowing sooty particles out to pollute the gas that lies between the stars. When we try to look through our galaxy, we have to look through all this soot, and just like that black cloud of exhaust, it obscures our view. And this is why we can have one or two supernova a century, and yet not have seen one for 400 years. Our understanding of the distribution of this soot has improved considerably since the last time astronomers calculated how easily we could see a supernova in our galaxy. In our study, we set out to update all these estimates and discuss them in the context of modern astronomical methods. The bottom line is that everything is consistent. Our galaxy contains so much soot that only about 1 in 10 supernova should be easily visible to the human eye, and that last supernova in 1604 was only seen by the naked eye. The first telescope was only invented 4 years later in 1608. Today, with 400 years of improvements, we find that our next supernova will be visible even to many amateur astronomers. We would also like to have measured the properties of the star before it exploded. We found that this can be challenging even with the world's largest telescopes. However, infrared light, like that used in a television remote control, passes through the soot. We find that existing surveys of our galaxy in this light already contain a picture of that next exploding star. Unfortunately, it is still a once-in-a-lifetime experience, and so we must all still wait to find out which one.
That was Christopher Kochanek of Ohio State University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.